Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, July 15th, 2021. A big show tonight. I'm going to be talking about the biggest comet in history. I'm going to talk about some other big stories like Richard Branson going into space. And of course, you've seen, hopefully you've seen, I put the video clip live on my webpage when it was happening. It was there for a couple of days. It might still be there if you missed it. I have the full thing recorded on my, it's just a pass through the embedded video of a couple hours. It's worth watching on my homepage, jmccsci.com. But I'll be giving some commentary that you will not hear anyplace else about Richard Branson's historical voyage into space. If I have time, I'll be making some commentary about what's going on in Cuba and other places in the world. The strange situation I just mentioned, the president of Tanzania, Burgundy, and now Haiti have all been assassinated. They were the three black gentlemen who were presidents of those countries who've been assassinated. And it's the only thing they really have in common, certainly not in the same part of the world, the only thing they have in common is they refuse to allow COVID vaccines or anything COVID into their country. They protected their country from this. And so, let me see. Also, I'll be talking about graphene and graphene dioxide in the water. Now, they've discovered this in some of the vaccinations. Of course, graphene is a highly toxic material. It's down at the nano level, so it's very small. But it's being produced, and just like PFAS chemicals, it's everywhere. It's in clothing, it's in masks, it's in you name it. It's all over the place. So anyway, it's very clear to me that it's going to be in the water systems. And just like for the same reason, it's in all of this stuff that gets used, all of these industrial uses, and then it gets into the water table. So I'll be talking a little bit about that. But first of all, another big thing here, a listener sent me this. And so I'm going to play an 11-minute clip. This happened in 2017. I was actually on the road, and I'm driving down the road in central United States. I'm driving around some hills, and all of a sudden the phone rings. And it's Alex Jones and the staff, and they call me up. They say, Alex wants you on the show this afternoon. I'm like, wow, okay. And this is, of course, with a live TV feed. This is not just I cannot do it from my cell phone and where I'm at. So I have to get to a place, set up a camera in like a mini studio to do this, and I'm talking about the weather at that time in Hurricane Irma being a manipulated storm. So anyway, I'm going to play that right now just because it was one of the last times I've been on Alex's show. I've been on there a few times, but be that as it may, it was a very active interview, and it's not the full interview. I think the full interview was maybe even an hour. I'm not sure. But Alex made a comment. He said, you know, James, I heard about you, and he was back in the early days, probably back in the Art Bell days in the 1990s when I was, and he said, the first time I heard you, I thought, man, this is crazy. Weather manipulation, who could even imagine that? And of course, I was working at that time with Russian scientists on weather manipulation as a result of the my electric nature of the universe theoretical work. And it very soon when I was working on this, I realized two things: that there was electrical activity, how to use it relative to weather manipulation, and how weather was formed, that hurricanes and tornadoes, etc., were formed electrically, not having anything to do with clouds rubbing together, whatever baloney they're trying to pass off on you. But anyway, Alex said, James, you know, first time I heard you on the radio, it was probably on Coast to Coast AM or something. And, he said, I thought it was, gee, that sounds pretty crazy. And then here we are a couple decades and a half later, I'm on his show and we're talking about manipulated hurricanes. And in this clip, now somebody took Alex's show and mixed in a couple clips of Cynthia McKinney, who was talking about a lady who called in from New Orleans, where all of these young teenage boys had been shot once in the head and then hauled off into the swamp to just dispose of the bodies, and that the Katrina event was a social, or what do you call it, a genocidal event is what it was. And I had been talking about that the whole time, that it was manipulated. And I lived in New Orleans, and I knew the city very well. I mean, I rode my bicycle as a student. I was at Tulane University for 2 years, and I didn't only go down to the French Quarter. That was one of my fun events, as I lived up by Tulane University at the end of St. Charles Avenue in a house off in the kind of way back on the north side of the university complex there. But in the afternoon, I'd get done with class on a Wednesday or Thursday or something like that or whatever. I said, I'm going to go downtown. So I'd go over and I'd get on a streetcar and I'd drive downtown. I'd go downtown and to the French Quarter, and there was jazz, there was music, there was all kinds of just wonderful. And then, of course, the people, talk about people watching. That was the good grief. Everybody from all over the world there. It was an amazing place. But I love jazz. I was in a jazz band in college. I earned my way through college, my spending money. I had my full ride scholarship and all of that provided. All my school was paid for with my scholarship money and everything. But my spending money, I made money in a jazz band. In fact, I was in a couple of them and made some pretty good money going around traveling and playing for events and proms and all kinds of events, every kind of event you could imagine, high school graduations, college graduations, everything. So anyway, the reason I'm mentioning being in New Orleans is because I really knew New Orleans very well. And so when Hurricane Katrina hit, and the next morning I woke up and I looked on I was not in New Orleans at that time, but I looked at the television screens and people are walking around downtown. There were light, misty rain. You know, there's no damage, nothing. And all of a sudden, they blow the levees in seven places and flood the city. And basically, those lower wards is what they flooded, where the poor people live, the blacks. And it was basically genocidal social engineering to wipe out those populations. Then they got the buses, they hauled all those people out of there, and we never heard what happened to those people ever again. We don't know. So anyway, I'm going to quick play this clip, and somewhere I probably have the full interview. People have been looking that. So anyway, by the way, this was sent in by a listener, and so if you do hear clips like this of shows like this, you know, send them in, because I can archive them on my end and have them for posterity. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to play this clip from Alex Jones' show. I almost said Alex Merklinger. That's out of the past, back in the early 2000s. I did a lot of shows with Alex Merklinger. And but anyway, no, this is from Alex Jones' 2017 interview TV on his cable channel. Also, I should mention, when you first start hearing this, it'll be my voice talking, and I'm talking to Alex. And then whoever put this together cuts in with the live interview with some TV people, which is much more recent, of this TV crew interviewing Michio Kaku, who is a famous physicist, and he's talking about how they're using lasers, about how smart they are in using lasers. Well, what they did is they stole my idea. The thieves in the physics world, and that's what they are. University professors and people like him are basically not very good scientists. So but anyway, you'll hear this woman's voice going, lasers something, and then the voice you hear after that is Mishukaku talking about how they're using lasers to enhance rain. So at any rate, and I'm sure he doesn't know about the real use of lasers, which is Tier 1 science. He's one of the classic Tier 2 scientists floating around the planet. And then also then they'll cut in, and sometimes they'll repeat my voice for effect. So you'll hear these things as you listen to this interview with Alex. And then Alex cuts in and starts talking to me. And then there's another woman in there, and like I say, that's Cynthia McKinney. And you can't see this on the because her name is on the screen, but I'm just telling you who that is. So here we go. I'll see you back. It's about 11 and a half minutes, and I'll see you at the after this clip plays.
Well, Alex, I worked with Russian scientists in the mid-1990s, and what we developed were two systems for degrading hurricanes, leading them offshore. And this information was given to the U.S. military because Russia really doesn't have a problem with hurricanes. We do. And the U.S. military, we knew that they had militarized this information in the early 2000s. They sent up three large satellites. They said they were for communications. We knew that they were laser satellites. And they have been using these to manipulate storms. That's when the serious storm manipulation problem began.
I mean, lasers, really, to change the weather?
That's right. Well, as Mark Twain once famously said, everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it. Well, instead of doing a rain dance, we physicists are firing trillion-watt lasers into the sky to actually precipitate rain clouds and actually bring down lightning bolts. This is potentially a game changer.
But this is experimental.
It's experimental. However, in the laboratory so far, it works. When you have water vapor and you have dust particles or ice crystals, you can precipitate rain. It condenses around the seeds. These seeds can also be created by laser beams. By firing trillion-watt lasers, you rip apart the electrons, creating what are called ions, and these ions act like seeds, like dust particles, bringing down rain and even lightning.
And the way they do this, hurricanes, we first have to dispel this myth that hurricanes are somehow created and maintained by warm water. Totally incorrect. The hurricanes are powered by electrical currents from the ionosphere, and what we learned is how to enhance and use those currents to steer hurricanes away from shore and away from harm of the public. Now they're using these, and you could see it with Hurricane Irma, was built and designed in the eastern Atlantic and just guided across. That's why these hurricane models supposedly predicted where they were going to go up Florida days, almost a week in advance. It's absurd. But this was one of the most manipulated guided storms I've ever seen, along with Hurricane Katrina, which was a totally manipulated storm for maximum destruction. This was to destroy Florida, evacuate Florida, just as Hurricane Harvey was to destroy Houston. What you have is a low pressure cell. And part of the manipulation is to manipulate the public into believing that this is caused by warm water. And so if the public doesn't understand the true nature of hurricanes, now we're seeing on the screen here, look at the eye. Is this Katrina? I'm assuming this
yes.
is Katrina. Yeah, it came in. And I just read some analysis from some weather reporters, how they were totally taken by surprise at the path and the strengthening of Katrina. It was totally off the records. It was totally out of control, but it was being controlled for maximum destruction of New Orleans. And look, we have no record of maybe millions of people that were in New Orleans. I used to live in New Orleans. I went to Tulane for grad school, and I rode all around the levees. Hurricane Katrina had already passed New Orleans when they blew the levee in seven places. The flooding was a result of blown levees from explosions, not from back surge from Hurricane Katrina.
And you're saying it was used for social engineering, I guess, is an example of how to use weather weapons to then clear an area?
Exactly. We don't know what happened. How many, possibly a million people in New Orleans we have no record of.
I had a woman... In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, I had a woman, I've never really said this in public out loud in front of a lot of cameras, and there's a lot of cameras in this room now. But I had a mother to call me because her son had a very gruesome task. Her son's charge by the Department of Defense was to process 5,000 bodies that had received a single bullet wound to the head. And these were mostly males. And her son was afraid to talk because he had signed a silence agreement. So he only complained to his mother. But the data about these individuals was entered into a Pentagon computer. And then reportedly, the bodies were dumped in a swamp in Louisiana. This is as a result of the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina.
By the way, they called it a conspiracy theory that levees got blown. They later admitted that they did release some of the levees. They did indeed blow some of the levees.
Yeah, I rode my bicycle around those levees as a student. I know those levees like the back of my hand. And for the concept that these were destroyed by a back surge off Lake Pontchartrain, totally absurd. These were blown to flood the city because New Orleans
is underwater.
Yeah, I
mean, these levees, you can, like you said, a bicycle, they're like, what, 10, 12 feet wide?
Oh, yeah, they're massive. They're massive. Yeah, there's a hurricane surge is not going to take these levees out. And we know that they were blown in the lower wards where the
by the way, we know gun confiscation happened. They denied that for a week.
Right.
It was later admitted. And just like the U.S. Virgin Islands confiscated all the guns, the U.S. Virgin Islands governor took the guns just last week again.
Right. And there's, again, Hurricane Irma destroyed these islands, and there was no need to do this. Now, Irma was a perfect example where they could have used the same technology to direct the storm north into the center of the Atlantic, completely out of harm's way. And they drug it across. Interestingly enough, they brought it way north of Puerto Rico and then brought it back down into Hispaniola, to Dominican Republic, Haiti, and then Cuba for maximum destruction. And then it takes a right turn exactly perfectly to come up the west coast of Florida. And they did that to maximize the energy and the storm surge. But they made a mistake. They could not maintain the energy in the storm. You could see them pulling it. I've posted a picture, by the way, on my webpage.
Well, isn't that because they're even admitting that because those bays are so shallow that they didn't get enough water?
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, they made Irma so big that it dumped most of its water out in the ocean. So it didn't have much rain. It was a dry hurricane by the time it got to Tampa. So it did not have much momentum. And so they failed. You could see them bringing it into shore and then bringing it back out into the bays along the west coast of Florida, trying to bring up energy, drive up energy. And you could see the distortion in the eye as they were doing this. See, the dielectric of the atmosphere, and this is what Tesla was doing. Tesla, back in the early 1900s, was tapping into this. That's what he was using his Tesla towers for. They were a mechanism for down on the planet Earth, drilling up through what I call drilling through the atmosphere. And once you do, you can unload that power from above. You can see down the eye. You put the laser there. You can drag these things around like a bull with a ring in its nose. You can increase the energy. You can decrease the energy. But the point is, these storms should never have hit any landfall at all. If nothing else, they should have steered this storm northwards in the Atlantic away from any harm. So I know they have the ability to do this. So why didn't they do this? Why did they direct it into Florida? And then Governor Rick Scott is and CNN pounding, everybody has to evacuate. Everybody has to evacuate. They were going for maximum damage in Florida. And that would have depopulated Florida. As it turns out, a lot of people stayed. There are people back in business. I know people in Tampa that are back at the office today. And so they failed. They failed at their objective. My view is this is the deep state. This is clearly the U.S. military that is in control of this. And we're looking at two population centers. What I'm worried about are other things like the Canary Islands forcing a landslide or causing earthquakes on the New Madras Fault Line or the San Andreas or messing with Yellowstone. We already know that NASA has proposed pumping steam into Yellowstone, and luckily the Park Service has said stay away. But that would create the biggest volcanic explosion we've ever seen in the world. But I'm worried about false flag EMPs, where they shut down, they pull the electrical grid. The number of rabbits that they have in their hats. But these are desperate people doing desperate things. That's why we developed it. And the Russian scientists were very advanced. University of Novosibirsk, Alexei Dmitriev, Alex Tetanov, and the crew there. And I was lucky enough to be associated with them. And the reason they wanted my theoretical work is because they were observing this and they didn't know what was causing it. So then they understood it. They broke it down. We said, okay, now we can use this because it's like a trigger. It's like having this energy system, and now you can control it. So you can control tornadoes. You can move tornadoes around. Tornadoes are the same.
So they're simply tapping phenomenon. Into the incredible amount of energy in space.
Absolutely.
And then pouring it into the Earth, directing it where they want with lasers.
Exactly. Exactly. You're taking a natural process and enhancing it. It's pervasive. Of course, the military's objective is to control everything. But a long time ago, we decided not to militarize space. The same Russian scientists in around 2001, once we realized the U.S. was sending up these laser satellites, they went to the United Nations and wanted a treaty. The U.N. wrote up a treaty for space-based, weather-based systems, and the U.S. refused to sign it. The reason the U.S. didn't sign it, because they wouldn't sign the part that would not allow them to use it against their own people. That's why the U.S. did not sign it, and that's what they're doing. They're using this against the American population. The reason the U.S. didn't sign it, because they wouldn't sign the part that would not allow them to use it against their own people. That's why the U.S. did not sign it, and that's what they're doing. They're using this against the American population.
Okay, everybody, this is the real live James McCanney right now. Back, that was the interview with Alex Jones, and you could hear the Cynthia McKinney in there, and I think the sound dropped down a little bit because just of the recording, but she basically stated that this was a genocide activity in New Orleans as a result of Hurricane Katrina at the same time where they were killing people, and this one person in the military job was to dispose of 5,000 bodies. And if you took 200 people like this and each one of their job was to dispose of 5,000 bodies, that would be, you know, hundreds of thousands of people genocided in along with Hurricane Katrina. That, of course, all of this happening under cover of darkness with the military in control. I knew that this was going on at the time, and I spoke up. I was on Coast to Coast talking about this. I was on various other shows, and I said, what's going on? Where are all these people, the black people, from those lower wards in New Orleans that were being bussed out of there, being taken out into the United States and never heard from again? Where are all these people? I mean, literally millions of people were disposed of there, and or deposed, let me just use that word, because we don't know what happened to them. Okay, I think this is very important because right now we're seeing in the world, the entire world, the planning that had gone into all of the governments of the world to take them over and be in position when the COVID thing came in, so that they could then lock down control, deal with populations. Now they're going door to door. They have volunteers, those just your friendly little neighbor down the street coming knocking on your door. Oh, just making sure that you got your COVID vaccine. Oh, my goodness. Is this bizarre old world that is coming? But this was all planned. And, of course, using the population against the population, this is standard Marxist Communist Manifesto techniques. This is what happened in the Ukraine in the 1930s. This is what happened in pre-World War II Germany. This is what happened I mean, right now in the world. And so this is what happened in Russia back in these pre-Tsar days. This is the technique where they come into a country, take it over, and then now I just want to mention Cuba. I mentioned Cuba at the beginning of the show, where you're seeing riots in Cuba. And I happen to have contacts around Latin America because of just my history. I have contacts around the world. But what's going on in Cuba is they're bringing in busloads of paid reactionaries, and that's what's going on in the United States. The January 6th thing at the Capitol in D.C. was all staged. It was all marketed. It was all promoted. And the end result was to arrest some hapless people that were there and then create a, you know, oh, the American Capitol was under attack, etc., and then react to that. And that reaction is what is going on. But in Cuba, of course, you had the COVID lockdowns and then the embargoes, which had been going on for 60 years now since Fidel, but becoming much worse during this. And the idea is to bring the people to starvation point, which they are now in Cuba. The one thing about Cuba is they do have local food. If they're out in the country, they probably have local food. So the people in the smaller towns and the cities, or I'm sorry, the medium-sized towns and cities are probably without food because they go to the grocery store. The people out in the country have food because they're raising it. They don't have Monsanto. They don't have, GMO chickens. They have, they're raising, they're probably, their food comes within a mile of where they live. And so at any rate, what they're showing is what's going on in the city. And the people of Cuba are very well versed that the United States government has been after the government of Cuba for a long time. So their technique is to go in, bring down an economy to the point where the people are starving to death, and then use that to politicize it against the people in the country. Okay, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail other than the only reason I'm pointing this out is because that's what's going on in the good old United States. And so you go, oh, that darn Cuba, those communists down there. Well, if you haven't noticed, the United States is far more communistic now than it ever was ever, sending out checks to the public, getting people on, you know, so the people don't want to go back to work with extended, unemployment benefits, etc. The United States is being socialized at a rate that's just is happening overnight. It's already happened. Okay, so that's about the first half of my show. The second half, I will be talking about the biggest comet in history. Now, this is very interesting because it was discovered by a couple of grad students who were using a telescope. I think they were from the one of the Massachusetts universities and discovered a comet. Well, it turns out that this comet is way, way out of the solar system, way out of the solar system. And people have been writing in asking me about this, and I really have been kind of remiss to talk about this. There's another comet out there called K2. That's just kind of drifting in also, but is allegedly going to be, I think, around the year 2023, will be out around the orbit of Mars. And I've captured the ephemeris for that comet, the original one, and because it may change. It may change. And the Smithsonian, which has the record keeping for comets and orbits and things like that, at least under Brian Marsden, who has now passed away and somebody else is dealing with the records, but had a way of changing sometimes on a daily basis without the records being kept. So it's important for me, being a cometary scientist, to keep those records so that we're able to compare future ephemeris, which is the orbital data of these things. Okay, but now back to the biggest comet in history, and they've named it now, so it's got an official name, but very clearly, the biggest comet prior to that, which was actually Hale-Bopp, was discovered unofficially as early as 1991. It was not publicly discovered until it exploded into brightness, and Hale and Bopp discovered it on the same night. Therefore, the comet term Hale-Bopp, the name is named after the discoverers. But Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory had discovered, and they had been watching it since 1991. And it was officially discovered by Hale and Bopp on July 15th, 1995, 4 years later. Okay, so anyway, it was one of the farthest comets to be discovered. And like I say, Harrington and the boys, well, Harrington died. That's another story. If you want some more information on that, read my latest book, The Planet X 2020, The Real History of Planet X. That's an e-book available on my webpage, in the libraries, etc. there. But this comet breaks the biggest record. And there was another comet in like the 1800s or something that was out beyond Saturn also, which became a big comet but did not come near Earth. Now, this comet and the one that we're talking about now, just recently discovered about a year ago, now it is currently way, way out of the solar system. And it's also on a path similar to that of, I'm not going to compare it to other comets, but it's on a path that is not in the plane of the planets. So when it comes through the plane of the planets, but it'll be out beyond the orbit of Saturn. Now, this is so bizarre because you can already see it's forming a comet. And but the sunlight out there that's supposedly in this dirty snowball comet model, and of course this is the contradiction that nobody, you know, the elephant in the room that nobody seems to want to talk about. This comet is nowhere near the sun at all. And if you were looking at the sun from this comet, it would look like another star. That's how far away this baby is. And so there's no way that the heat from the sun or the solar wind from the sun or whatever they claim is heating this up to cause a comet tail. But now here is the twist. How do you measure the size of an object that far away? It's just like a dot of light in a camera. It's like, you know, one pixel and or maybe two or three, maybe in one of the bigger cameras. But how do you determine the size of this thing? So what they do is it's called an albedo or a light measurement, right? Light reflectivity measurement. And so what you do is you determine how far away this thing is from the sun. Okay, then you take and you assume an albedo. Now, the albedo is the brightness of an object. Like snow would be near one. Zero albedo is like perfectly black. And so somewhere in the middle is stuff in outer space. And so let me just read off some albedo values of other, say, the planets, just to give you an idea. Okay, and this is for experts out there. This is using what is known as the bond albedo, which is the actual physical albedo that you would measure. And the albedo is simply a ratio between the reflected light that's coming back versus the amount of sunlight that gets to the. So it's a very simple concept. How much light is getting there? How much light is coming back to you? And so Venus, which is that bright, bright star, the evening and the morning star, is a 0.75. And so that's white. It has these white cloud tops. It's really reflective. Earth, if you're up in the space looking back at Earth, is a 0.3. Jupiter is a 0.34, so Jupiter is a very bright object also. Saturn is a 0.34 also, so it's very bright. Anyway, that's kind of the range of planets. So now but here's the deal. What they're doing is they're assuming that this big comet out there is an ice ball, a snowy, white, pure white object out there. And so they go, wow, this thing is, and then, of course, they can calculate the amount of sunlight that's getting way out there, even though it's a little teeny cross-section, they can calculate the amount of sunlight that's hitting this object and then being reflected back. So they make a calculation, and assuming that this is a bright white object. But, of course, we've been to dozens of comets now, close up, nose to nose, and they're not white at all. They're black. In fact, Halley's Comet nucleus is the blackest object ever recorded in the solar system. That's how black the nucleus of Halley's Comet is, and that goes for all the other comets that we have been close to. Okay, so now what happens? The reality is that the nucleus is black. So if you assume that the nucleus is pure white, an albedo of 1, then that makes the object very small. And they're talking about 160 miles across. They claimed that Hale-Bopp was 42 miles across. So this thing would be much bigger proportionately than Hale-Bopp. But of course, they lied about that, because Hale-Bopp was the literally Planet X that Harrington discovered, and that's what I discovered in my work after a long time of researching this. And you'll see in my early writings, I talk about that the size of Hale-Bopp was way off in the NASA so-called calculations. And by the way, with the old, this is interesting too, with the old Arecibo Observatory, they could directly measure, because of reflection of radio waves, they're not blocked by the material in the comet coma, they could directly measure the size of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, but they never did. Now, why would that be? And of course, since then, the Arecibo telescope had a little accident in which it was totally destroyed because of irresponsible maintenance of the cable system, or was it sabotage? Sabotage, can you say that word? Okay, so anyway, I'll be using that word a little bit later in the broadcast, talking about some other things. But the end result here is that this object out there, if you assume it's pure white, then you get a size of 160 kilometer diameter. Now, if it's pure black, that means you're dealing with a black surface, so you're getting that amount of radiation coming back off of a much larger surface, which means this thing could be 100 or 1,000 times bigger than 160 miles. If it's 100 miles bigger, then it's twice the size of Earth. If it's 1,000 times bigger, it's 20 times the size of Jupiter. Okay? This is just giving you some round numbers. So, of course, these graduate students, and I've been in scientific meetings with graduate students like this, they're dumb as a tree. They don't know anything. They don't know anything about the history of astronomy. They're just kind of little greeny idiots floating around these university halls. And they've never read anything other than what Carl Sagan told them or their professor told them in astronomy. And, of course, those people are tier two scientists. They really don't know anything either. They're so smart, they don't have to read anybody else's work. But anyway, be that as it may, the end result is this comet that was just discovered is potentially 10, let's just say conservatively, and I would put this at the 1,000 range. In other words, a comet nucleus that is as black as the albedo of Halley's nucleus, which is probably about a 0.001 albedo. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say a 0.01, which would be 100 times the size of the estimated 160 miles. So that would be 16,000 mile diameter object. Okay, so this is twice the diameter of Earth. It would be like 2 squared. So the diameter is twice, dealing with the volume that's cubed, so that would be 8 times the mass of Earth. Now, I remind you, don't get worried, don't start generating YouTube videos that Mr. McCanny says the new Planet X is coming, because this thing is not going to come anywhere near even the major part of the solar system. This is going to be way out by Saturn. It'll come through, but it'll probably be a pretty good light show. But I'm also looking, we don't know enough at this point to talk about any electrical alignments. Like, could it align with Jupiter or, say, some of the other planets and cause across solar system electrical discharge, which is potential. I mean, if it's already a comet and it's way out there. But see, the other thing is that it's out in what's known as the Kuiper Belt. And that's what I've been saying all along. is that the Kuiper Belt is a place where large comets are forming. Now, this comet just happens to be on a path coming into the outer regions of our solar system. And so just let me make it very clear. No, this is not some kind of Planet X that's going to shatter the solar system. And I'm sure that everybody will pick up on us, all of the nutcases out there. We'll try and make a buck by selling a book that the world's going to end. And I just want to make it clear on this radio show that, no, that is not the case. Okay, so at any rate, very important to talk about that little deal. Now I'm going to talk about graphene in the water. Here's an issue. I've talked in the past about PFAS chemicals. Where did they come from? They came from industrial processes that over decades and decades of use in firefighting foam or in other industrial things used out on the runways or in aircraft or in trains or other industrial settings. And it leached eventually into the water table. Now it's there. It's everywhere. But what about graphene? Graphene is one of those products, too, that is like going to save us all, but it's being used every place in all kinds of products, in clothes. It's been found in masks that you wear for COVID, etc. And then people are breathing these in. They're highly toxic chemicals. And so, in fact, they found that one of the major vaccinations that's being pushed on the public now is, in fact, loaded about 98%+ graphene dioxide, which is a highly toxic material. So they're injecting this extremely toxic material into people. And, of course, now let me mention this. At the very beginning, when all of this COVID stuff started, I said, you know, from the respiratory problems these people are having, they go into a hospital, they're choking. It sounds like somebody is sprinkling fairy dust. And that's what I called it, fairy dust, that some kind of nanoparticle that gets in people's lungs, and they go into a hospital and they can't breathe. So they stick them on a ventilator and blow their lungs out and they die and they call it COVID and all of these deaths, etc. And I think they stopped doing that very quickly because they realized that some doctor is going to do an autopsy and not going to find any COVID. He's going to find nanographene particles that cause the inflammation, because all you'd have to do is look at the inflammation point in the lungs, look in there under a microscope, and you would see graphene particles. You're going to say, hey, this ain't no COVID-19 virus thing. This is fairy dust. This is somebody out there sprinkling this around the public. But it was enough to get the COVID thing going to where everybody was jumping up and down. And now that's turning out to be the case. Doggone it, I hate when I'm right all the time. And I knew it because the people were getting sick. They were having a hard time breathing. Okay, just a thing here I saw. I'm going to mention this. There's some woke woman's study graduate woman, and I saw her on the arguing with fishermen. Lobster fishermen, and saying that the lobsters feel pain when they're boiled alive, so therefore you couldn't do that anymore. They had to kill them in a different manner. The next step will be plants have feelings. So we can't eat plants anymore because it'll hurt their feelings. That's where this is going, folks. I mean, and this woman was totally serious. Yes, the lobsters have feelings. The crabfish have feelings, and we just can't. And the reason they're boiled live is for a number of reasons, because they go bad very quickly. Like in under 5 minutes, a dead lobster starts to develop toxins, very bad toxins. That's why they drop them in the water live, because if you kill a lobster and then try and freeze it, in the time it's freezing, it's going to be developing toxins. So the little woman studied ding-dong, excuse me, and that's what these people are. You know, like I say, the next thing is going to be that plants have feelings, so therefore you can't, when you eat corn, you're hurting the corn, you're hurting the corn's feelings, and so you can't eat corn anymore, people. This is where it's going. When you see the Looney Tunes come out of the woodwork, that's where it's going. And by the way, don't you think if you kill a lobster by any other means, it's going to hurt too? How do you find a way to kill a lobster that it's not going to hurt their feelings? Excuse me, Banana Land. Okay, on to, I have one topic left, and that's dealing with Richard Branson. Now, I sat and I watched this last Sunday, July 11th, and from what I understand, this is Branson's birthday. This was his birthday present to himself. And he was astronaut 001, and they had a lot of drama with it, which I thought was very good myself. And a lot of people go, oh, yeah, Richard Branson, he keeps putting himself up as the number one character. Well, look, if the guy's got billions of dollars and he did something that nobody else could do, which he won the Ansari X Prize along with Burt Rutan. He's the guy that came along, and it was, I think, Ellen had put some money in. In the beginning, and then Branson came along and was the one who dropped all the bucks into it that pushed it through and finally won the X Prize. So Branson was the owner. Then they created that was the Spaceship One, which I saw. I've got a picture of Spaceship One with Burt Rutan. Burt Rutan, by the way, is retired now. I think he does more fishing than anything else. I met him personally at the San Diego Air America Space Show. San Diego, it was back in the maybe in the 90s and the 80s. I don't even remember. Many decades ago, Bert was there, and he had his cowboy boots and his beard and his long, not really a beard. He's got like these big sideburns. And so anyway, I talked to him about the projects I was working on. I was an invited speaker at the Air America show in San Diego. It was like the United States answer to the Paris Air Show, but it never got off the ground. But anyway, Bert was there. I was there as an invited speaker. And I talked to him about maybe collaborating on some projects, which we never got going because I never had the funding that I needed to develop my projects. So anyway, Burt Rutan was the designer of the Long Easy, of many of the canard type of aircraft, very stable, etc. But anyway, he picked up on Richard Branson, came in with money, big chunk of change, probably $10 million, and won the original Ansari X Prize to go into outer space. And I feel a bit kin to this also because I myself am an alumni of the X Prize, being in the Water Abundance X Prize, and a finalist and the receiver of the Technology Innovation Achievement Award of X Prize, and a sizable stipend to keep working. And that's where I had my 50 kilowatt wing generator powering two of my 1,000 liter per day atmospheric water generators to produce 2,000 liters of water in a single day for under 2 cents a liter. That was the X Prize. But anyway, but to see the drama, etc., leading up to this, and then here's what I want to talk about a little bit. The staff that he had there was absolutely excellent. And you see this also in the X Prize. And by the way, the Ansari X Prize is what launched the whole private space industry. There had been people doing things prior to that, like the Bigelow Hotels and the other efforts. But this was the thing that crystallized it. And a $10 million prize, the prize in my X Prize was one of the smallest in terms of prizes. But Branson won that. Then Branson goes on to develop the technology and starts Virgin Galactic, which is actually a company in his Virgin line to go into outer space. But it was very interesting that Branson is talking on Sunday. They have some of his interviews, and he was talking about how he, as a kid, was just enthralled with the idea of going into space. And NASA, and of course, he's from England, and so the English government was involved with NASA and the space program. And he said he waited and he waited and he waited and he waited some more. And he said it never came. And that's one of my criticisms of NASA is with trillions of dollars, well, billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, many, many hundreds of billions of dollars over a 60-year period, there was never a space program. Well, where's the space program? There wasn't one. And certainly nothing that would ever lead a kid to dream about going into space because it just never happened. So Branson, with his money, just moved it. And if you look at, say, the pilots that Branson had flying his, the carrier vehicle was called Eve, and the six-passenger, I forget what they called the six-passenger glider rocket plane that went up into space, but the pilots that flew these, I mean, the credentials are incredible. You know, I can't even explain it on the air. And then he was going along to examine the customer experience because they're commercializing this. They're going to start selling trips, and people are going to be paying hundreds of thousands of dollars, who knows how much, to go into space for, you know, maybe a minute of weightlessness, and then they come back down and land. And they can do that over and over again. They just replace the rocket engine and go up again. And so anyway, he's starting a space. He built his own spaceport out in the middle of the New Mexico desert. Their original spaceport was in Mojave Desert out in California. That's where Burt Rutan's location was. And so anyway, my hat's off to him, but that's not what I want to talk about, because you can see all the fanfare, all the hoopla on the internet and on the repeat of the radio of his historical flight into space. But here's what I want to talk about. Now, at the very end, when he comes back down and he lands and he gives a speech, he's talking about what an important day it is, but he's talking about the ups and downs of the business. And I'll tell you, I have had ups and downs in my business, and any person who's really in business knows about ups and downs. But Branson had a couple times in his career as head of Virgin Galactic where they had some deaths because of mishaps, and they were both explosions. Now, one of them, the very first one, was soon after the XPRIZE, probably within a year after the XPRIZE. They're out there, they're testing solid fuel rockets. And on the test pad, one of these rockets blows up and kills one of the engineers, maybe two. I don't remember the whole scenario there, but when it happened, I said, you know, this is a bit strange. And I thought to myself, is somebody out there trying to block him? Because they were almost ready at that point to send their first tourists up into space. And this was a test, just a rocket engine test on a fixed platform down on the ground. And it blows up and kills the guy. So that shuts down their program, of course. And now they start developing the bigger version, which is the glider rocket plane that can carry six people, I think six passengers and two pilots, I think is the load. And when they went up this time, it was four passengers and two pilots. Maybe it's six total, I'm not sure. But anyway, as they were getting up almost to the point once again where they were going to open it up, and this was a couple of years ago, to tourism, like within a few months, all of a sudden they have an accident and the rocket engine blows up again. And I'm thinking, you know, wait a minute. And this was during a flight. I think the one of the two guys on there, one of the guys lived through it, and one of the pilots was killed. And, of course, that shut him down once again. And Branson is not the kind of guy that would come off and say anything. Neither, like people like Musk, is not the kind of person. Musk had some things where they had rockets going up, and the payload exploded mysteriously, which, of course, aborted the issue. But I'm not going to talk anything about Musk today because he's had his own set of issues. But Branson, unlike Musk, never got the big investment of money coming in. When Musk settled his case where he was suing the government because he was not getting military launch satellites or launches to the space station, he sued the government. He said, look, I got as good a chance as the old boys, the Boeing boys, etc., of getting these payloads into space. And the day he settled, he got an investment of $1 billion, or with the B, just like Carl Sagan would say, $1 billion, and from Google and Fidelity, they threw $1 billion into Musk's company. Richard Branson did not get that kind of infusion. I think he has some other partners. He's not 100% owner. I think he's like 51% owner. But he did not get that massive investment. And so anyway, my point is that the use of runway to space has now been proven. Their next goal, I'm sure, will be eventually to go into orbit, which is a whole other thing. Right now, they're just going straight up into space. They come straight back down, hit the glide mode, and then glide around over the desert and come back in. And so anyway, but soon, they're taking steps, and these are incredible steps. I mean, the vision, and of course the people in the know that the runway to space has always been the way to go. That's, if you look on my webpage, I have a space hotel launch system. You can go see there. The pictures are there, the artist renditions, etc. And someday, if I have my way, I'll be going into outer space with my hotel system. And there is where you could have tourism on a very large scale, and as many as 10 to 20,000 people in a space hotel. That's big business. That's going to be there. But my launch system is very unique in that, just go look at the pictures. You'll see what I mean. And I do not have the pictures of my space station prototype, but I talk about that in my book, The Diamond Principle, which is, I don't know when I published The Diamond Principle. I don't know, maybe at least a decade ago, where I talk about that, my concept for the space hotel concept. But anyway, my hats off to Richard Branson. My goodness, what an amazing accomplishment. He deserves all of the fanfare, and he dedicated this to his mother, Eve, who was also quite a person. If you look at his history and his family history, etc., so you can kind of see where he got his impetus as a kid, where a lot of us were, mowing lawns and shoveling sidewalks like I was. He was developing businesses. Anyway, once again, my hats off to Richard Branson. Dedicate this week to him. Go watch the video. It's really worth seeing. By the way, I have sales on all my water filter stuff, free shipping. The two websites, jmccsci.com and jmccwaterfilters, plural.com, jmccwaterfilters.com. And that's it. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.